right. Our fifth case for this morning is Winston against Boatwright. Mr. Long. So here we still are with Batson, Mr. Long, but a very unusual way of encountering this question.
Well, Your Honor, this case arises under the Strickland versus Washington framework rather than Batson and JB directly. But when we're looking at this case under Strickland, we have to actually harmonize the Supreme Court's precedent in the context of jury discrimination with its precedents in the context of Strickland. And as this Court well knows, Mr. Winston has to show both deficient performance and prejudice under those standards. And I'm going to address prejudice first and emphasize, Your Honors, that in order to show prejudice, Mr. Winston has to show only a reasonable probability of a different result. It's not that it's certain that there would be a different result, not that it's more likely than not, but that there's a reasonable probability of a different result.
So you, in a sense, I think, on the prejudice side of this, have the task of somehow blending the Strickland prejudice inquiry, which, as you rightly say, is really what's technically before us, with the underlying rule in Batson that requires automatic reversal should there be a Batson violation, or JEB, if you will, violation found.
Yes, Your Honor, and there are a few considerations in that regard. For one, we have to look at the fact that Strickland requires the court to presume that the decision maker was reasonably applying the correct standards to the facts, when the actual question under Strickland is whether the composition of the decision maker was a problem. Then you have to do some work harmonizing that with the Supreme Court's precedents on the automatic reversal rule that applies in Batson and JEB. As has been pointed out by some courts looking at this issue, really the reasonable way to apply the Supreme Court's precedents on this issue is to look at the result of the relevant proceeding, the relevant proceeding being actually the result of jury selection. Reason being, if you're actually looking at the result of trial, you're requiring the defendant to come forward with essentially arguments that are in violation of JEB and Batson themselves.
That wouldn't have happened if it had been the direct Batson or JEB inquiry. That's true. Could I just ask you, though, a preliminary question? Do we need an evidentiary hearing in this case to find out whether Mr. Winston's lawyer excluded all the men from this jury? Or is this letter, I mean, it's a fairly casual little bit of information. And I didn't see the letter in the record in this court, is it?
Your Honor, the letter is not. The actual letter is not in the record. If the court requires it, we have it in our files. We can submit it. The entire transcript and various other materials were submitted by the state, but this particular letter was not. Now, our position is actually that the state court's opinions in this case actually adopt the factual predicate for their opinion what is said in this letter. So it's not casual in the sense that this court, we're not asking this court to just directly rely on that letter, but the fact that the state court's relied upon that letter as the factual predicate.
But this time you're using as a sword the fact that we rely on the state court's findings of fact. You say, yes, take the state court's assumption that there was deliberate exclusion of all the men.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Part of the reason for that, Your Honor, is that a respondent at no point before the district court sought to challenge that factual predicate for the state court's opinions and in fact endorse them once again, saying that counsel's behavior here was reasonable and that there was no prejudice based on Mr. Winston's version of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the key considerations here under clearly established federal law is analysis from the decision JB versus Alabama. In that decision, the Supreme Court warned about particular categories of cases in which peremptory challenges based on gender would be harmful. And the Supreme Court warned that in these cases, there is a particularly acute problem with an invitation of cynicism as to the jury's neutrality and its obligation to adhere to the law.
You were making, in a sense, a broader argument. You were saying it can never be reasonable performance to adopt a strategy that violates the Constitution. And by the time you take Batson, JEB, and McCollum together, there's nothing constitutional about the strategy of deliberately excluding all members of one protected group, whether it be all members of a race or all members of a gender.
I would agree, Your Honor, that in order to characterize that strategy as reasonable, one has to characterize as reasonable conduct that the Supreme Court, in decisions including JEB, has specifically condemned. The Supreme Court has warned that to use gender as a predictor of jurors' attitudes is improper. However, I don't think this court needs to adopt a across-the-board per se rule that there's always deficient performance whenever there is a violation of Batson by defense counsel or JEB by defense counsel. This court can look at the particular facts of this case that indicate that gender was really at issue in this case. It's a sexual assault.
Is that because of Boyd?
Boyd really did deal with something totally different than this case. And Boyd, and there's two reasons for that. For one, Boyd was a case involving waiver. But to speak more to your question, Your Honor, Boyd was not a case involving allegations against the defendant that had any particular racial dimensions. So when there was a challenge against a juror based on the juror's race, that had no nexus with any allegation that had been made against the defendant. So this court in Boyd had no occasion to consider the clearly established law, which actually would have been Powers versus Ohio in that context, that warned about the particularly pernicious effect of discriminatory peremptory challenges in cases where race is at issue, similar to what was said in JEB. The court had no occasion to apply that in Boyd.
So how are we to view then the DNA evidence where his DNA was found on her neck and breast, and the explanation was given that this beer spitting was what caused it? And, you know, you have a jury that found him not guilty on the rape, the sexual intercourse, but guilty on sexual contact. So how do we put that in the context of this prejudice?
Once again, Your Honor, at the outset, I would emphasize once again the fact that Mr. Winston has to establish a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the result. And that confidence is already severely undermined by the racial discrimination tainting the formation of the jury. But in more direct response to your question, this jury's not guilty verdict on the sexual intercourse charge necessitated them to disbelieve the testimony of the victim, who was the only eyewitness to the alleged crime other than Mr. Winston. They obviously did not believe Mr. Winston's testimony either. We don't know why. Other than that, there was DNA evidence that Mr. Winston's DNA was found in the breast area of the victim. One thing we have to keep in mind is that when we're looking at whether there's a reasonable probability, Mr. Winston's first trial resulted in a hung jury, and there was DNA evidence at that trial as well. So it's not an outlandish idea to suggest that there could be a reasonable probability of a different result here on that issue. Moving to deficient performance, I have one more thing to remind the court of on prejudice. The Jackson versus Herring decision from the 11th Circuit is really instructive here as to how clearly established federal law should be applied in terms of JB's teachings and Powers versus Ohio's teachings about particular categories of cases. In that case, of course, the petitioner lost and was unable to show prejudice. But part of the reason that was so was that the 11th Circuit reminded us that there were no racial dimensions to the allegations against the defendant there, just as there were not in Boyd. So the court said had there have been such racial dimensions, there would have been considerable doubt cast upon a verdict that was returned by a racially unbalanced and unconstitutionally composed jury. And here we had a very unbalanced, gender-wise jury that was formed by unconstitutional means. So we have the same situation that casts severe doubt upon the verdict that jury returned.
So if this case is retried and the defense strikes, peremptorily strikes a male juror, can the prosecution then ask for an explanation of that strike? Is it a prima facie case of discrimination shown there?
I think it depends on the circumstances. Under Georgia versus McCollum, the prosecution can certainly challenge in a situation where there appears to be a challenge made on the basis of improper criteria by the defense. The prosecution is entitled to challenge that. Yes, Your Honor. Moving to the deficient performance angle of this case, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. JEB specifically warned that it's not proper to use gender as an accurate predictor of jurors' attitudes. And here that appears to be the only basis on which counsel exercised the 6 of 8 peremptory challenges against males. He said that female jurors would be less sympathetic to the victim than male jurors were, and that was apparently his only basis. This court has dealt with situations before in which there was no conceivable strategic benefit behind some action that counsel took. For instance, one example we cited in our briefs was a Gentry versus Sevier decision, where basic constitutional principles dictated that a certain motion to suppress be filed, and that there was no conceivable strategic benefit in refraining from filing it. There's an analogy here, which is basic constitutional principles under JEB prohibited counsel's conduct, and yet he went about it anyway without any strategic benefit. This court should reverse. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Neuser.
Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Attorney General Mark Neuser appearing on behalf of the respondent in this matter. Petitioner M.C. Winston stands convicted of second-degree sexual assault by conduct after he was found guilty of getting a 15-year-old girl drunk in the back of a candy store and sexually assaulting her. As Your Honor pointed out, his DNA was found on her breast. In this case, Winston comes before this court asking for 3 very unusual rulings, particularly within a habeas case. Number one, he asked this court to evaluate a Batson challenge 8 years after trial, without a Batson objection having taken place at the trial.
Of course, let's back up, because this is a Strickland case.
Yes.
It's not a Batson case, except that the ineffective assistance of counsel alleged here is that the defendant's own counsel adopted a strategy in flagrant violation of JEB versus Alabama. And the Supreme Court has made it very clear, as I said in the earlier argument, that the interests implicated by the line of cases that began with Batson go beyond the individual defendant. They are societal interests as well as individual defendant interests. So the idea that one can adopt purposely an unconstitutional strategy is, it seems to me, a pretty hard one to swallow. I mean, and I gather you would agree with me that if in a particular case, let's say a white defendant has his lawyer strike all the African Americans from the jury, we'd have a pretty serious problem.
Yes, that would be a serious problem. But
why isn't this exactly the same thing? This man who's on trial for these very unpleasant offenses has a lawyer who decides to strike all the men from the jury.
Well, it's unlike that for a couple of reasons. First of all, as Your Honor mentioned during petitioner's argument, the entire reason why we believe that trial counsel was striking all men because they were men was because of this rather breezy letter that does not appear.
So I have a follow-up on that,
yes.
Though. I mean, I understand the argument that the state courts have so found, in which case,
right. All right,
if they found it, we'll take it, just like we always take the state court's
right. Findings.
If not, however, it seems to me it might be a vitally important fact to nail down in an evidentiary hearing, and I personally am satisfied that there's been enough of a request for such a hearing to go forward with one.
Well, I respectfully disagree that there has been enough of a request to go forward with one. They've already just said they don't need one whatsoever.
Well, they're arguing the alternative, which people do all the time, but I'm looking at their opening brief, and their opening brief ends on page 37 by saying, in the alternative, the judgment should be vacated. Mr. Winston should, at a minimum, be granted an evidentiary hearing.
Right.
So they want to say, we think the state has found this, but if for whatever reason you don't agree, we want it. Don't you think a violation of the Constitution is important enough to make sure it doesn't happen?
Well, first of all, they did make the casual reference at the end of the brief, yes, in the alternative, we would like an evidentiary hearing, but they did not bother to go through 2254E2, which is the code requirements for getting an evidentiary hearing.
If the state court didn't make a finding, then it's something that the state court didn't do, and you satisfy E2. Obviously, they're in the position where their primary argument is that the state court's done it, and it's done it not in your favor. It's done it in their favor.
Right. Well, let's take even one more step back. The only reason we're here is because this is a Strickland challenge, right? If this were a straight-up Batson challenge, it would have been waived, and we wouldn't be here whatsoever. So to prove Strickland, you have to have deficient performance and you have to have prejudice.
So you'll agree that the performance was, for the time being, you don't have to agree permanently, but suppose we all agree that the performance was deficient.
Okay.
Because counsel should not adopt a strategy in violation of Supreme Court rules. Let's talk about prejudice.
There is absolutely no evidence on the record that the jury that was selected, the all-female jury, in any way prejudiced his ability to get a fair trial.
Of course, under Batson and JEB, we never ask that question because it's a structural condition for the trial.
Well, but again, we're here under Strickland, and if you look at the Boyd case.
It's structurally, Boyd is interesting. It depends how broadly you read it. You could read Boyd to say the exercise of a peremptory in violation of Batson, this is actually a quote from the opinion, does not entitle the defendant to a new trial unless the challenge amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel. All right, so that takes us right back to where we are.
Correct, but I'm going to quote another piece of language from Boyd, which is the way the Boyd court articulated the prejudice standard, which is nothing in this record suggests that the removal of the stricken member of the veneer produced a jury that was likely to convict an innocent person or even a jury more likely to convict a guilty one. Here we have absolutely rock-solid DNA evidence that has his DNA on her breast. And here we have a jury that produced a verdict that is directly in line with that DNA evidence. Why should we simply assume that the jury was unable somehow to fairly and impartially decide the evidence when we have a verdict?
Nobody talks in Boyd about the community interest in making sure that the jury process isn't distorted.
Well, it could be.
Or it wasn't presented with that, it appears.
Well, that's also true, and I don't believe Boyd was either a habeas case either. If we're going to decide whether or not Boyd should be either implicitly or explicitly overruled, then we have to start thinking about whether or not we're in Van Patten land, where we're wondering whether or not we actually do have clearly established Supreme Court precedent.
Absolutely.
The fact that petitioner has asked this court to perhaps take this case up en banc because we're going to
I'm not sure Boyd needs overrule. I mean, I think reading Boyd carefully tells you what Boyd holds. But I would agree with you that if you're suddenly talking about overruling things and all the rest of it, it's very difficult to say there's clearly established law.
Right.
I think that's right.
I agree. And I think on that ground alone, our position wins. So on the prejudice prong, I simply think there has been absolutely no proof that M.C. Winston was prejudiced by the all-female composition of the jury. After all, a defendant does not have a constitutional right to a particular composition of a jury. He does have a constitutional
right. So if this had been, again, to do the racial analogy, the Supreme Court has never worried about whether, an all-black jury could fairly decide the rights of a white defendant or an all-white jury could fairly decide. But we find a problem in that composition of the jury nonetheless.
Sure. Sure.
Why doesn't that, when performance has yielded a jury that's constitutionally suspect, why isn't that an example where the prejudice inquiry is precisely that, that there's just a constitutionally problematic jury?
Well, again, if I'm interpreting your question correctly, you would be suggesting setting up a per se prejudice rule. In other words, if you have Batson violations in the ineffective assistance context.
Right,
correct?
Which, based on what the Supreme Court itself has done with Batson JEB violations.
Right. Well, I still disagree that there is clearly established Supreme Court precedent that would confirm that there is it would be appropriate to make a per se rule of prejudice. And in fact, I'm going to go back to the Boyd decision. It says, giving a defendant a new trial because of his own violation of the Constitution would make a laughingstock of the judicial process.
But it wasn't his violation here. It was his lawyer's,
Which
without any knowledge of his.
Well, I don't know if we can assume that it was without any knowledge of this.
Now I'm back on my evidentiary hearing.
Right, exactly. It's very confusing to me that we're assuming somehow that the defendant had no knowledge of how these strikes took place. I mean, at least in Wisconsin, the common practice in a trial as you're going through jury selection is defendant is seated right next to his lawyer, and the two of them, although it's off the record, of course, because it's attorney-client communication, typically they work together on making the strikes. There's absolutely no evidence in this record that MC Winston had no idea that this was going to be an all-female jury. Evidence in the record.
I thought his lawyer pretty much told him to shut up.
Well, that's an allegation in his petition, and we don't necessarily have to accept everything in the petition as true. Now, if I may continue with my reading of the Boyd case, if a decision of the Supreme Court gave the accused the right to bootstrap his own violation of Batson into a new trial, we would be obliged to enforce that holding, but there is no such decision. So I think it's very clear, and this Court has already recognized, that we're in uncharted territory here. So in the habeas context, petitioner has simply failed to show that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals unreasonably applied Strickland. If there's no other questions.
No, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your time ran out, but I'll give you another, at least I think it might have. This time ran out. Anyway, I'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Reserve 3 minutes. I'm not sure
when the red light turns on, it actually means you've already used it up.
Thank you. Well, I want to address a few things that counsel addressed. First of all, in terms of there being a lack of clearly established law, one of the principles under AEDPA is that it can be an unreasonable application to unreasonably refuse to apply clearly established principles in one context to another context in which they should apply. The automatic reversal rule of JEB and Batson that is regularly applied by courts needed to be applied into this context. So that's the clearly established law we're saying needs to be applied here. In terms of Mr. Winston having knowledge about how his attorney used the strikes, we have to remember that Mr. Winston was prohibited on the record at the outset of the trial from making objections about his counsel's conduct unless he wanted to risk going forward by himself pro se. So even if he did know what went on, and Mr. Winston has clearly asserted that he did not, there was an obstacle to him getting up in front of the court and saying, I have a problem with what my lawyer is doing, because he would do that at peril of losing his representation. The court actually said, we'll send Mr. Turan home. In terms of – I'm out of time, Your Honor. I was going to address Boyd, but I will sit down.
All right. We have your briefs, and you took this case by appointment, did you not? And we appreciate very much your help, that of your firm, for the court and for your client. And thank you as well. Attorney for the state. We'll take the case under advisement.